Welcome to the world of productive laziness, and the theme of this podcast is fun. If you remember rightly, I wrote a book, The Project Manager Who Smiled, which was released at the end of last year and has proven pretty successful. You can still get a copy, but I was delighted to be asked by someone else who does podcasts, Andy Kaufman, who does the People and Projects podcast. And Andy said he was interviewing some people who'd written a book all about humour. And so I was just intrigued at that. And actually what it turned out to be, there's a new book out. It's called The Humour Code. And it's written by two gentlemen. And they're kind of analysing what makes things funny. And it just, you know, one, I was delighted to be part of this podcast. And secondly, it is a really interesting one. So I had a chat with Andy, and I asked his permission to include his entire podcast into my podcast. And he was generous enough to say yes. So the podcast you're going to hear is a standalone podcast from Andy Kaufman. It's the People and Projects podcast. And this one's called The Funny Thing About Project Management. And that's it, really. That's all I'm going to say, because the podcast itself stands alone. It was just great. I think it's worth listening to the whole podcast, because at the end you get to hear some pretty famous project managers from around the world attempting some humour, and you know, you should enjoy that. And yeah, check it out. The Humour Code is the book they're talking about. It's People and Projects podcast. It's Andy Kaufman, and you know, I was just pleased to be part of this, and I loved listening to the podcast itself. So hopefully you will also enjoy.
So a project manager and a bear walk into a bar, okay? So the bartender asks, "So, what can I get you?" The project manager says, "I'll take a Coke, please." The bartender turns to the bear and asks, "What about you?" And the bear says, "I'll have a milk." The project manager says to the bear, "So, what's with the long pause?" Hi, this is Andy Kaufman. I know that may not be the best project management joke you've ever heard, but hey, if you listen to the end of this episode, all the way to the end, you'll hear some of the biggest voices in project management share one of their favorite jokes, all right? Thanks for joining me today. Welcome to the People and Projects podcast, where you'll find interviews and insights to help you deliver projects and lead teams. You can find us on the web at peopleandprojectspodcast.com. I love to laugh. You know, whether it's a podcast episode, a keynote presentation, or an e-learning workshop, I like to keep it lighthearted. I've just found it's easier to learn when you're enjoying the experience.
The more I fill with glee, and the more the glee, the more I'm a merrier me.
Yet though I share the name of a famous, albeit dead, comedian, Andy Kaufman, I'm not really that funny. I really have to work at it. And because of that, there are times when a joke not only isn't funny, I mean, it's counterproductive. You know, perhaps someone is the butt of the joke, so to speak, and they don't like it. Or is making light at a time or a subject that just wasn't appropriate.
Yeah, so I think what your example highlights is really what a slippery concept humor is. Yeah. That what one person sees as okay, another person sees only as a violation, and then a third sees as a benign violation. And so one person yawns, the other one groans, and then the third person laughs.
That's one of my guests today, Pete McGraw.
I am an associate professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Now, Pete's not just an academic.
The more interesting thing that I do is I direct the Humor Research Lab, a.k.a. HURL.
Yeah, you heard that right. Pete's lab is called HURL, the Humor Research Lab. Now, how's that for a funny name? My other guest today is Joel Warner.
I'm a writer. Based in Denver, Colorado. I was formerly a staff writer for Westword, which is the alternative news weekly here in Denver. But I've also long written for a bunch of magazines, both in print and online.
Pete and Joel are the co-authors of a new book entitled The Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny. Why is it that some things are funnier than others? When is it that humor can help us? And when can it get in the way? Pete and Joel traveled the world to dissect humor across cultures to learn what makes us laugh. You'll learn about humor is not just for stand-up comics and class clowns. Since you and I are in the business of delivering projects and leading teams, we'd all benefit from learning how to use this important tool for mutual benefit while avoiding the landmines of inappropriate use. So whether you love to laugh or not, let's hear from Pete and Joel for insights to help us lead. Today, we're talking with Peter and Joel about their new book, The Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny. Pete and Joel, thank you for joining us on the People and Projects podcast.
Thank you, Rob.
Great to be here.
So we've got this highly regarded new book co-written by an academic humor researcher and a journalist. So, Joel, what's the backstory about how the two of you hooked up for this project?
So I was formerly a staff writer at Westword Newspaper, where I'd write long-form magazine stories, and I was always looking for new stories. I really enjoyed writing about people who had kind of extreme passions for things. And I heard mentioned that there was a professor up at the University of Colorado Boulder who had a university-sanctioned humor research lab, a.k.a. HURL. I said to myself, that's a story.
Yeah, exactly. And so, so Pete, this guy calls you, and what was your first thought?
I welcomed Joel's call. We hit it off rather quickly, and one of the things that we want to do in the humor research lab is try to make the study of what makes things funny part of a greater dialogue. We didn't want just academics talking about it. We want regular everyday people to get interested in this idea. And so I was, it's happy to become a subject.
Yeah, well, Joel, you did a great job of weaving this story of how to do it. And as I read it, Pete, I have to think, My theory on what makes things funny before I read the book would have more aligned, I think, with what you call the incongruity theory. I guess that's how I would have maybe described it. So give us a highlight of that theory and maybe a couple of the other models that compete with the one that you assert in the book.
Yeah, so my question for you is, what version of incongruity theory do you subscribe to?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. So here's my take on that. Well, we talk about it in our family sometimes. I mean, this would have been years ago when they're younger. It's like, well, what makes it funny? The surprise. Like, it was, you weren't expecting that to come. So that's not exactly incongruity, but is that one of the versions of it? It was the surprise?
It is. It's actually one of the earliest versions. So Schultz says that humor arises from a conflict between what is expected and what actually occurs. And I think if you ask the everyday person on the street, that's the sort of most common response to the question of what makes things funny. Yeah. In scholarly circles, there's other versions. So there's this idea of juxtaposition, so having two kind of seemingly incompatible perceptions in your mind. Mm-hmm. All of those, I think, do a pretty good job of explaining what makes things funny. They unfortunately short-circuit when you start trying to explain the things that are not funny. So, for instance, unexpectedly bad things, car accidents and so on, are surprising, but they're rarely humorous. And so what a good theory needs to do is differentiate what's funny from what is not funny. And that's where incongruity theory starts to struggle. Mm-hmm. The other theories also seem to have those kinds of problems. So, for instance, Freud put forward a version of what's called relief or release theory that we tend to laugh at kind of aggressive or sexual ideas that come out in kind of okay ways. Or one of the first humor theories put forth by Plato and Aristotle that still exists to some degree today is some version of superiority theory, the idea that we laugh in using Hobbes' words, when we witness some version of sudden glory. So when bad things happen to people that we tend to not like or not care about.
So, of course, Pete, your theory, the benign violation theory, I probably ought to ask you, but I thought it might be interesting to have Joel take a swing at it in layman's terms. Joel, how would you describe the benign violation theory?
The way that Pete's always described it to me is that the benign violation theory, which he developed with his collaborator, Caleb Warren, and actually built off earlier work by a linguist named Thomas Veitch, is that according to the benign violation theory, humor arises when something seems wrong or threatening, but at the same time is somehow okay or safe. And for me, the best illustration of that is tickling, which is a concept that has stumped a lot of humor theorists over the years. Some of these theorists just kind of avoid tickling altogether because it doesn't seem to fit very well into things like incongruity or whatnot. But according to the benign violation theory, it seems to fit very well. It's this idea that tickling is a physical violation. Now, it also, you know, has to be benign. For example, you can't tickle yourself because there's no violation there. At the same time, if you're walking down the street and some creepy stranger walks up to you and tries to tickle you, there's nothing about that that's benign, so you won't laugh.
Right. That makes sense. You know, there's a project management session we do where we talk about risk management. And it shows, perhaps you guys have seen this before, it's almost like a closet in the floor right by a POS system. And this woman is like taking money out of the POS system, and somebody walks down. They open the door to the closet in the floor, you know, so there's this gaping hole, and she turns around, but she doesn't look down, and she falls down the stairs. And we talk about it in the context of risk. But it's so interesting because there'll be some groups I'm with, they laugh their head off at it, and other people, they're like, you know, it's like, oh my goodness, is she okay? And so there's a violation there. Right? Because, you know, obviously someone gets hurt, but is it benign because, well, maybe she's okay, or how's that break down, Pete?
Yeah, so I think what your example highlights is really what a slippery concept humor is.
Yeah.
That what one person sees as okay, another person sees only as a violation, and then a third sees as a benign violation. And so one person yawns, the other one groans, and then the third person laughs.
Yeah.
And so context matters a lot. So what was happening leading up to that? Was it sort of a playful kind of situation? Had people already been laughing in advance of that, and so they interpret this as something that's potentially funny and okay? Or was it a very serious topic before this video is shown? So, and then there's also this idea of just what are the people like in the audience? You know, so are they highly empathic? Are they less so? You know, and so... As a result, the very same joke, the very same video can have these wildly different reactions. And it's why, like, for instance, America's Funniest Home Video tries to stack the deck in their favor, right? Mm-hmm. So they put this sort of energetic, upbeat kind of happy music along with the clip. They've got this studio audience that's laughing along, indicating to the world that this guy getting hit in the nads, you know, is it going to be okay? This is a funny kind of situation, because otherwise it could be a really horrible vision for people to have.
Yeah. All right. So despite sharing the name Andy Kaufman with a famous, albeit dead comedian, so I'm making no claims about being funny. So, but I really want to understand this theory, and I want people that are listening to us to understand it as well. So I'm going to give you an example of a line I use in a project management workshop, and it usually gets a chuckle. Okay. So, it'll come up where we're talking about the importance of expressing appreciation to people, and someone will inevitably go, you know, my boss just totally doesn't get it. I mean, he or she, they just don't express appreciation. I'm like, oh, so it's like the old married couple where the wife is like, you never say you love me. You never say you love me. And the husband turns and he says, hey, I told you on our wedding day, if anything changes, I'll let you know. Okay. It seems to me there's a violation, but it's benign. So how would you break that one down?
So this is off the cuff, and Joel will back me up when I say I'm often reluctant to do this. I'd rather run the study in Hurl. But here's my suspicion is, you know, the violation is kind of clear. The idea that just because you say it on your wedding day doesn't mean that you shouldn't be kind of relatively, you know, reinforcing this belief in the mind of your partner. I think what helps make that situation okay, you know, makes it benign, is that you made this very public, permanent vow because it happens on the wedding day, you know, and so in that way it sort of makes sense, and it creates some acceptability there.
Yeah, it felt to me like it's kind of benign because it's so extreme that it would never happen. So they get that this is not telling the story of my parents and tough childhood, you know, something like that. But I have to tell you, I'm on a search for violations because of your book. So nothing else.
Oh yeah, I think it's a good place to start.
Yeah.
So Jerry Lewis has this. Has this clip that comedy is a man in trouble. You know, so the person whose life is going along perfectly, really, you know, maybe very happy, but there's not a real great place to look for jokes.
Yeah. So I was listening to a podcast interview recently. The person being interviewed, best-selling author, he's getting along in age, and he's just sharing a lot of stories of his years in selling and marketing and all this stuff. But he mentioned the importance of humor in selling, and, you know, I kind of got that. But he also said he had a humor coach, which I thought was interesting. And the interviewer kind of got him to say, all right, well, tell me a joke. And I have to tell you, it wasn't really funny. Now, I mean, it could have been me. It could have been all kinds of other things. But I thought it was kind of interesting that the author just really, really laughed when he said it. But I don't know if anybody else did. And to me, it was a great example of how we may think we're funnier than we are and how difficult it is to be funny. And maybe the wisdom of hiring a humor coach as well. But Pete, I mean, do we think we're funnier than we really are? Is there any evidence of that? And why is it so difficult to come up with this funny material?
Yeah, so one of the things that Joel did for me, and I'm greatly appreciative. I'm more appreciative now than I was then, is that he invited me to go to a local open mic and critique the comedians. Use a benign violation theory. And in a moment of hubris, I said, well, why don't I get on stage and tell some jokes? And so I have a lot of empathy for this guy because I wrote some jokes in rather quick fashion that I thought were funny.
Yeah.
I got on stage, I told these jokes, and I was the only person who thought these jokes were funny.
Yeah, right. I don't even thought they were that funny when you got up on stage and started.
Well, yeah, good point. While I was telling them, I was like, oh, these are not very good jokes. Now, what this highlights, I think, is this idea that, first of all, if anybody in the world thinks that you are funny, it's going to be you, you know, because you perfectly share a sense of humor with this person.
Right, exactly.
And as soon as you move outside of that, you risk failing, and you risk failing in one of the two ways that we discussed earlier. And it's why the stand-up comedians of the world, they figured out that they can't just rely on their intuition, no matter how good it is. They need to test these jokes.
Yeah.
And your author and this humor coach should be, if he or she is worth the pay, should be saying, "Are you should be revising that joke. Okay, so it was a good starting point, but let's try to make it better based upon this sort of palate reaction that it keeps getting." What do we have to do? Do we have to make it more benign? Do we have to make it more of a violation? Right? Do we have to make it more okay or more wrong?
Yeah. You know, I remember in the book, there was something, it kind of reminded me of a Lake Wobegon sort of moment that, you know, everyone is above average. Something like 94% of people claim that they're average or above average with their sense of humor or something like that?
Yeah, and that's one of the challenges that human researchers have had over the years is, you know, is trying to test people to rate people's sense of humor. You know, first you have to figure out, I mean, how do you define a sense of humor? Is it your ability to create jokes? Is it how often you laugh at jokes? Is it how well you remember jokes? Yeah. People haven't really nailed that down. Even when they do, they can't figure out exactly how to actually rate them. I mean, you know, your obvious thing that you just mentioned is to have people self-rate, but most people find their own jokes pretty funny.
Well, yeah. Right.
So the thing is, I mean, would there be a legitimate, sustainable way to figure out people's objective sense of humor? I don't think we've found that out yet.
And as interesting as this is, I got to tell you, I think the people listening to us are not trying to win the New Yorker cartoon caption contest or be a stand-up comedian. So I think it'd be interesting just to focus on how the research impacts a leader in the workplace. So, you know, Joel, based on what you learned during this project, I mean, how do you think it could help, let's say, a project manager or some other leader to better understand humor?
One of the big takeaways that I have through this whole project about traveling around the world with Pete is how much you have to think about the butt of the joke. You know, we often think about, well, what is the joke about? But if you really think about who the target is, and you have to think about it almost like a target, because, I mean, this is something or someone who's going to be facing some form of violation or an attack.
Yeah.
And that can be really kind of risky. So, for example, if you want to use humor in your presentations, in your communications with your employees, you have to be really careful about who you make the butt of your joke. You definitely don't want to make the person you're speaking to the butt of the joke unless it's really necessary. What most stand-up comedians do when they first get up on stage is they make a self-deprecating comment about themselves. They turn the humor upon themselves, and that suddenly disarms the audience. That suddenly kind of makes the person speaking, telling the jokes or communicating, it kind of brings them down a bit. And usually will let the audience open up to what they're trying to say.
Do I remember there was something, and Pete, maybe you take a swing at this, was something about innovation was increased if there was more humor in the workplace. Do I remember that in the book?
Yeah, I think that there's a tendency for when people think about humor in the workplace is to immediately go to trying to create kind of a fun, funny environment, right? So these sort of workplace consultants will say, oh, you got to create a fun, funny environment. But really, I think that the usefulness is when it's much more targeted. So, for instance, you know, organizations have a lot of trouble problem solving. They have a lot of trouble innovating. And there seems to be some good evidence emerging that humor might be a good tool in those kinds of situations. So, for instance, can you, instead of trying to identify problems that could serve as a foundation for new products and services and so on, might you take an approach where you make fun of the things that are out there in the world? And if you can make fun of those things, you can actually find the things that are wrong with it. And so it's an easier, more fun, more engaging way for employees to take on the kind of sacred cows out there, right? So this is the way we do things, but we really need to find a new way to do it. And using humor in those brainstorming sessions, in those meetings and so on, might be a very good way to do it, because you're creating positive emotions, you're broadening your perspective, and you just have a more engaged set of employees. They're going to persist longer on these kinds of tasks.
You know, even as you said that, I was thinking back to, was it Domino's who even used that idea in a campaign of like, we realize our pizza tastes like cardboard. I mean, they used it as a very targeted way to, and it was self-deprecating and it got people's attention, but then it helped them get their message out as well. So
yeah, it spurs this idea of like, we fixed this problem. We've acknowledged that we've done something wrong. Yeah. And here's the better pizza coming your way.
Yeah. I was intrigued. This is a little bit related to what Joel said, but there's often a loser in a joke. And so, Pete, could you elaborate on that? And what do we need to keep in mind when we're using humor to maybe make it less likely we get ourselves in trouble or work against us?
Yeah, so one of the things that Joel and I have been talking a lot about is this idea of a joke that people will groan and say, too soon, too soon. And the idea is that in the face of a tragedy, that you should probably wait some time for some of the pain to wear off before you can, it's appropriate to make some jokes. Yeah. What we found is that is indeed the case. But if you're adept, you can make jokes and laugh in the face of tragedy. So when we were in New York City, we met with one of the longtime writers for The Onion. And The Onion published a set of articles within like 10 days or so of the 9/11 attacks. And they recognize this. They recognize that choosing the right person to make fun of is going to be really an important thing. And what they did was they took aim at the terrorists. And so that Onion article, set of articles, was widely found, well, people found it to be really funny, and they were also really appreciative because the jokes that they made were at the expense of the terrorists. So what it did was it took and made an inclusive community, the people who had felt, you know, threatened and attacked, and then turned their attention on someone who was the enemy. And so in this way, I think Gruner's approach to superiority is, you know, can be correct. Actually, can be a good way to go about creating comedy, as long as you find the right victim, as long as you create the right community in order to figure out who's laughing with and who's laughing at.
You know, something else related to this, I can relate it better in a story. I had a really tough boss once. I mean, I like to say that she was the best boss I ever hated to work for, actually. And and there was so often so much tension in the room when she'd come in that I would try sometimes to use humor, whether I even realized it or not. I guess after reading your book, I think I was signaling it's okay is what I was trying to do. But I was cracking jokes in the, you know, just, you know, probably my own tension as well as others, I think, appreciated. She did not. And I think what it came off is Andy's not taking it seriously. Right. And you have an example, I think, in the book about, was it a teenage pregnancy campaign and the way they went about it? Wasn't there something related to that?
We partnered with this, with the National Campaign to Prevent Teenage Pregnancy. And they were using humor to really push an envelope in their sex ed PSAs. But they wanted to know whether that really helped. So, so we flew out there and we made a series of the very same PSA. Several used different types of humor, all of which said the exact same message, and one was basically a straight reciting of the facts. Yeah. And the results were kind of surprising. While people found the humorous ones more memorable and engaging, the one that inspired the most people to actually seek out more research was the really boring one. And that kind of speaks to exactly what you said. His idea that humor might signal that, hey, what we're talking about is all in good fun. This does not have to be taken seriously. This is, you know, this is something to be just joked about. And I think Pete put it really well when he says, does that mean that we should never use humor in marketing or our communications? No. But you have to think about when and where you use this humor. And if he put it, you know, the one way to do so is to think about it like a good wedding toast. Mm. Is start with the good joke, and then put all humor aside and get right down to business.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I feel like the book provides this really nice balance between not only dissecting the frog, so to speak, of dissecting the humor, what it is and things, but also the benefits, but also kind of keep an eye on this other side of it as well. And I think in the workplace, we'd be well served to understand that. You know, Joel, you followed this mad humor scientist around the world to learn about what makes people laugh. So can you say you're a funnier guy today than before this whole thing started?
Well, one thing that's funnier is that, you know, in some ways I was kind of the one just kind of taking notes, just chronicling this whole adventure. Yeah. And the original kind of point of it was to see if Pete learned anything along the way. So at the end of the book, he once again tried his hand at stand-up at the largest comedy festival in the world, the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal.
Yeah.
Now, what I wasn't expecting was right around that time, a good friend of mine said to me, you know, Joel, I think you've gotten funnier. And that completely caught me off guard. But then when I thought about it, I thought there really might be some value to that. I use Pete's benign violation theory, you know, sometimes in my daily life. I'm not going to say it's just because of Pete's theory that I'm somehow become a funnier guy.
Yeah.
In many ways, I think it's just because of exactly what you said. I went around the world with a humor researcher from the heart of the Amazon with Patch Adams to Japanese game show sets to meeting with comedians in the West Bank. And suddenly, I just have a lot more material that I can mine for humorous observation.
Right.
I think that's key.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. But I think there's also something about when you become aware, all of a sudden, like I started since Christmas, I'm wearing a Fitbit around my wrist. And now I see them all over the place, you know, and I didn't see them before. And I think when all of a sudden you become aware of the theory, all of a sudden, oh, that was a violation. You know, I don't know. I just wonder if we just become more aware when we become more knowledgeable about the topic. So let's say someone listening to us, they just want to inject more humor into their team interactions. So, Pete, what are a couple practical recommendations they could try, even if they might consider themselves, maybe even on the introverted side? You know, what are some things they might try?
One place to start is, this is something that Joel and I quickly figured out when we were in the West Bank, and that is that if you want to be funny, to have more humorous interactions, it's to look for those points of tension, to look for the things that are seemingly amiss, because that's going to be the foundation for the joke, for the quip, for the witticism.
Yeah.
And then the key, though, of course, is to create a safe space, a playfulness that allows that thing to be okay in some way. And so, so for instance, in the Humor Research Lab, we actually have a norm, an expectation that people are going to make jokes, that it's okay to joke around about things. And I think that ends up sort of providing a little bit extra motivation for the people on the team to take the chance, right? Because especially if you're introverted, you have to put yourself out there and be willing to fail. And then I think that the real important thing is, if this is going to be something that's part of your team culture, is that people are quick to apologize and quick to accept an apology if things don't go their way. So I regularly get in trouble trying to be funny, and And what I like to say is, this is what happens. Well, first of all, I say, I'm sorry. And then I say, this is what happens when someone who studies what makes things funny tries to be funny.
Yeah, I was watching a guy emceeing a meeting. It was with a bunch of flight attendants and from all over the world. But this one table had a bunch of people from... it's from different Asian countries. And he goes, well, this is our table of Asians, he said. And he thought it was really funny. Afterwards, some of those people came up to him and they felt like, I can't believe you said that. That's so racist. And he right in front of everybody, he goes, I got to tell you, I am so sorry. I didn't mean that. But I think the fact is, as we try to get funny, beyond our intentions, some of that's going to happen.
Yeah.
But so let's be aware of it. And like you said, recover from it. But let's also try to find some ways to find the funny side of life. I love how, I think it's even on your last page, you know, watch fewer dramas, more sitcoms. You know, you know, find out, look, remind yourself everything's going to be okay. I think there is something to be said. There's a lot of stuff to really be depressed about, right? And
yeah.
So find some ways within the team to say things are going to be okay. Try to make it funny.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, you know, for those listening, if you want a behind the scenes look at what makes things funny, get a copy of Pete McGraw and Joel Werner's new book, The Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny. I've included links to the book and the book's website in the show notes for the cast. So, Pete and Joe, thank you for joining us on the People and Projects podcast.
Thanks so much, Andy.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you.
Why the long face? Just saw the two-legged man win the three-legged race. What gets lost is never found. It's out of bounds and up in space. I laughed out loud when you showed up with chocolate frosting on your face. We could all use a little laughter.
Hey, please join me and other podcast listeners for an interactive discussion about this episode. On Thursday, April 17th, 2014, we'll be gathering for an hour to talk about this episode, as well as a couple of recent ones, including key lessons and ways to apply the learning. Hey, there's no cost to join, and if you're a certified PMP, you can earn a free PDU. Join us on Thursday, April 17th at 1 p.m. Central Daylight Time in the U.S., which is GMT minus 5. So how do you register? Go to peopleandprojectspodcast.com/109 to get a link to register. Thanks. Hey, as promised, stay tuned for some project management humor from many names that you're going to recognize. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the People and Projects Podcast. Have a great week.
You a boy whose father died. His blood like tomatoes was dripping dry. I knew a girl who, no matter how she cried, what follows after is laughter. You know that I have to laugh. A little
Hello everyone, this is Cornelius Fichtner from the Project Management Podcast, and I have a simple question for you. How many project managers does it take to screw in a light bulb? The answer is, it takes two. One to screw it in, and a second one to tell the first one that this would have been so much easier if only they had used agile project management approaches.
Andy, it's Rick Moores. So here goes one joke for you now. Backstory is we had a sponsor that sent a mailing out to all of our stakeholders. I got the mailing because I was a customer as well. That's how I found out about this. That was accelerating a project that would take 11 months to do. two, 4 short months, announce the end date to all of our stakeholders before even discussing it with us, the PMO. When I approached the sponsor, I said, we were going to have to do some nasty risk management with this project because there's no way we're going to be able to do this in such a short time. That sponsor looked me dead in the eye and said, Rick, this project has no risk because it must be done on time. Which leads me to my other second joke or favorite joke. That joke is the 13th floor principle. If you ever get into an elevator like I just did in New York City, you'll notice that most elevators do not have a 13th floor. Call it superstition, call it what you will. But you'll see an elevator jump from the 12th floor to the 14th floor as if it doesn't exist, just like that sponsor did. So when you look at something like this, we call it the 13th floor principle. That's when somebody will look at this elevator, and if you look outside, I'll look at this hotel, and I'll see that it's a solid building, that there's nothing that will jump time and space as if there's no 13th floor. But I've got a little news for you. For the people that are staying on the 14th floor, there's actually a 13th floor, and you're staying on it. But most people will call it what they will. They'll look at that and say, well, if we just don't acknowledge the 13th floor, therefore it doesn't exist. Just like risk. If we don't acknowledge the risk, it doesn't exist. But for all of you on the 14th floor, it's really the 13th floor.
Hi, this is Margaret Maloney, community leader at PM Students. And today I wanted to share with you a little story I call Leap, Then Look. This is an urban legend that a friend shared with me. You know, if you've ever worked with a boss that likes to just jump out there and react before he or she gets the facts, then you're going to really like this. There was a company, and they felt it was time for a shakeup, so they hired a new CEO. And this new CEO was determined to prove himself by getting rid of all the slackers. So he tours the facilities, and he notices a guy leaning against the wall. And the room was full of workers, so he really wanted to show everyone that he meant business. So he walked up to the guy, and he says, how much money do you make a week? The guy looked at him surprised and said, well, I guess about $400. Why? And the CEO reached into his pocket and gave the guy $1,600 in cash and screamed at him, here's a month's pay. Get out. Don't come back. The CEO then felt pretty good about himself. And he looked around the room and he said, does anyone here want to tell me what that goofball used to do here? And from across the room, a voice said, pizza delivery guy from Domino's.
Hi, my name is Alfonso Bucero. As a project management practitioner, I would like to share with you the joke I'm using to convince my project stakeholders about if you need to sell your project, you need to believe in. Let's imagine a gypsy man who wants to sell a horse to a Spanish man. And the gypsy man says, okay, Spanish man, I want to sell you a horse. Oh, I don't need any horse, answered the Spanish man. Yes, you need it. You are 5 in family. You have 3 children. You know, this horse is fantastic. This horse is getting up very early in the morning, picking your children up to the school, okay, and doing everything at home. When you are coming back in the evening, everything is done. You don't need to take care about nothing. The horse is fantastic. It's doing everything at home. Believe me. Okay, gypsy man, I don't believe you. But anyway, I'll buy the horse. So the Spanish man buys the horse, and 2 months later, they are meeting each other again. And the Spanish man says, okay, gypsy man, you were lying. This horse is a helpful horse. You know, this horse is doing nothing at home. He has not gone to the school. He has not picked my children up to the school. He is doing nothing. He is a lazy horse, all time sleeping. I don't believe that type of attitude of this horse. I hate the horse. Please go away with the horse. And the gypsy man smiles and says, you know, Spanish man, continue talking about your horse in that way, and you will not be able to sell it again.
Hi there, Andy and listeners of the People and Projects podcast. This is Cesar Bade from the Project Management for the Masses podcast, which you can find at pmforthemasses.com. And here's my favorite little joke, or you could even say a little tale, related to management and project management. You might have heard this already, but it's an oldie but a goodie. It's one of my favorite stories. Here's how it goes. Start with a cage containing 5 monkeys, a banana, a ladder, and a hose, all right? Now, inside the cage, you hang a banana on a string, and place the set of stairs under it. Now, before very long, one monkey, right, that's in the cage will see the banana and the stairs and will try to get to the banana by climbing the stairs. Now, as soon as the monkey touches the stairs, you take the hose and you spray all the other monkeys, okay, with cold water. Not the monkey that's trying to get the banana, but the other ones, all right? After a while, another monkey will make an attempt with the same result, right? All the other monkeys are sprayed with cold water. Now, pretty soon the monkeys kind of get what's going on here. So whenever another monkey tries to climb the stairs, the other monkeys will try to prevent him by attacking them, right? Now, put away the cold water. Take and remove one of the monkeys from the cage and put a new monkey in the cage, okay? This monkey doesn't know about this rule, right? So the new monkey sees the banana and will try to climb the stairs. Now, to his surprise, all of the other monkeys will attack him, right? Now, after another attempt and an attack, he kind of gets the gist here, and he knows that if he tries to climb the stairs, he will be attacked, so he doesn't do that anymore. Now, once you get to that point, you replace another monkey, right? One of the original five monkeys, replace it with a new one. The newcomer goes to the stairs and is attacked, right? The previous newcomer, who had never seen the hose or the cold water, will take part in the punishment, right? With enthusiasm, even. So, likewise, replace a third original monkey with a new one, then a fourth, then a fifth. And every time the newest monkey takes to the stairs, he's attacked. Now, most of the monkeys that are beating him have no idea why they were not permitted to climb the stairs. But they participate in the beating of the monkey anyways. After you replace all the original monkeys, none of the remaining monkeys has ever been sprayed with cold water, never seen the hose. And yet, no monkey ever again approaches the stairs to try for the banana because they're afraid of being punished. So, well, besides the fear of being punished, why don't they try to get to the banana? Well, because as far as they know, that's the way it's always been done around here. And then, my friends, is how company policy begins.
Hi there, my name is Peter Taylor and I am the Lazy Project Manager and I'm delighted to share some fun with you today. I wrote my own book with contributions from project managers around the world. It's called The Project Manager Who Smiled, and it tries to prove the value of fun and bring some fun to project teams around the world. But let me tell you this particular story. I'm working on a particular project. It's a tough project, you know, and I'm working closely with a whole bunch of great people. But two of the people I'm working closely with are a systems architect and a database administrator. And we've been working, had some tough few days. So I suggest one lunchtime that we go for a walk and to get some fresh air and you know, re-energize ourselves. And we're walking down the beach, as you do. And as we walk down the beach, the DBA suddenly spots something in the sand, shining, and bends down and picks it up. And guess what? It's a lamp. And the DBA rubs the lamp because it's covered in sand and dirt. And lo and behold, a genie emerges in a puff of smoke from the lamp. And the genie turns to us and says, "I grant you three wishes." "Oh, hang on. There's three of you. So I grant each of you one wish." "Okay, who's first?" And the DBA, who spotted the lamp to start with, said, "Oh, I'm first, please." And the genie said, "What is your wish?" And the DBA said, "Oh, you know what? I'd love to have a Ferrari. I'd love to have a beautiful house in South America. I'd like to have unlimited quantities of beer, a fast speedboat, beautiful ladies, and party, party, party." And the genie said, "Well, that's easy." And with a click of his fingers, the DBA was gone. And then the genie turned to the remaining two of us and said, "Who's next?" And the solution architect said, "Me, please, me." And the genie said, What is your wish?" And the solution architect said, "Oh, I would love to have a beautiful house in Monte Carlo. I'd like champagne and handbags and shoes." It was a lady. "And I'd like a nice car. I'd like a beautiful sailing boat. I'd like handsome men to wait on my every need." And that would be fantastic. And the genius said, well, that's easy as well. And with a click of his fingers, the solution architect disappeared. And then the genie turned to me and said, well, the one last wish, that is your wish. What do you desire? You know what? Project management is great. And I try and be the very best project manager I possibly can. And I try to do a good thing and do the right thing for my projects. And so after a little bit of thought, I turned to the genie. I said, can I have those other two back at their desk at 2:30, please? We've got a lot of work to do.
Hello again, this is Cornelius Fichtner with a slight twist on the question I asked you earlier. This time my question is, how many PMPs does it take to screw in a light bulb? Do you know? The answer is, it takes two PMPs to screw in a light bulb. One to screw it in, and the second one to ask the first one, but we're going to get PDUs for this, right?
Hey, this is Andy. You know, in the podcast episode, I referred to the hunter joke, okay? So this is supposed to be the funniest joke in the entire world. Well, how do we know that? This guy named Richard Wiseman, he's a British psychology professor. He ran a place called the Laugh Lab. Over 12 months, people submitted 40,000 jokes and nearly 2 million ratings from people in 40 different countries. So this is like the largest ever scientific humor study. They even got a Guinness World Record, all right? So in 2002, Wiseman announced that they'd done it. They'd come up with the world's funniest joke. You want to hear it? Here it goes. Two hunters are out in the woods when one of them collapses. I mean, he doesn't seem to be breathing. His eyes are glazed. So the other guy whips out his cell phone. He calls emergency services. He gasps, my friend is dead. What can I do? The operator says, hey, calm down. I can help. First, I mean, let's make sure he's dead. There's silence and then a gunshot. Back at the phone, the guy says, okay, now what? Okay, that's terrible, right? I'm not sure why I'm laughing, but that's terrible.